Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as lawmakers argue over what to do about tens of thousands of unaccompanied minors coming to the U.S. from Central America, there are some really contradictory messages coming from Washington.
If they do make it, they'll get sent back.
The vast majority of these people need to go home and will eventually go home.
You know, are you going to actually deport that child? To me, it is a free pass.
Deport children seeking refuge from extreme violence.
Deport them quickly without due process.
Due process, adjudication, and representation for these children.
Children who are fleeing brutal violence.
Deport, deport, deport.
So there's a sampling of the political rhetoric, but we have a rare opportunity now to look inside the real world of immigration court, where thousands of the immigrant minors from Central America are now being fast-tracked with the goal of sending as many back who qualify to be sent back as quickly as possible, and if they don't qualify, to stay. With us is the president of the National Association of Immigration Judges, Dana Lee Marks, who has been an immigration judge in San Francisco for 27 years. Welcome to WNYC, Judge Marks. Hello from New York, and thank you so much for doing this with us.
Thank you for the opportunity, Brian.
By way of introduction, have you seen a big spike in cases involving Central American minors over the last few years?
Yes, we're definitely feeling that increase all across the system. While those minors tend to be entering the country at the border areas in Arizona and Texas primarily, they do join family members and friends throughout the United States. So there has been an increase for all of the immigration courts across the country.
The word in New York is that immigration court is about to be filled with those minors even more beginning next week, in a new fast-track program to put these cases first. Are you seeing that about to happen in your courtroom as well? Is that a federal government or national push?
Yes. I'm in San Francisco, and we're seeing it here, but it is a national directive that the immigration court caseload be shifted so that juvenile cases and cases of recent arrivals will now be the priority for non-detained cases.
So who needs to prove what in these cases for you to rule that a minor here alone qualifies to stay or will be deported?
Well, immigration proceedings before the judges across the country really always have two components. One is whether the person is in the United States legally or not, and it could be that they entered without any proper documents, or it could be that they entered legally as a visitor or a student and did something that violates the conditions of their status. Usually that part of the proceeding is not very hotly contested. But where we really spend the bulk of our time and where the law gets extremely complicated is to assess whether someone has any remedy or benefit or protection that they are entitled to under our immigration laws. And as part of that, we also have international treaty obligations that immigration judges are charged with enforcing. The obligation that the United States would never return someone to a country where their life or freedom would be threatened or where they would be persecuted by their home government.
It's really a very complicated issue. How can you know, as a judge with a large caseload, what an individual child's actual level of danger is if he or she is sent home?
Well, that's why what we hear in the press kind of makes judges cringe, to be perfectly honest. We have to address these cases, each one individually, case by case, to see what the individual circumstances are, to have those facts proven to us, and then to determine how the law applies to that individual fact situation. Because it's not just a by-the-numbers kind of analysis. It's much more nuanced.
So, for example, can you tell us a story? You know, I'm sure you don't want to name names of people who came through your court, but a story where the government was claiming that there wasn't enough danger and the child was claiming that there was enough danger to qualify for whatever category of asylum or whatever, and how you dealt with the uncertainty?
I'm going to change your question just slightly. Often the issue is not how much danger this person is in, but whether they qualify or satisfy the requirement of the law, which requires that someone show that the harm they either suffered in the past or that they genuinely fear in the future is on account of a protected statutory ground. Because someone can suffer horrific persecution in the past, but the law requires that it be inflicted by either the government or a group the government cannot control, and that it be because of either their race, their religion, their nationality, their political opinion, or because of their membership in a particular social group. And many of these cases where people have been harmed by the gangs are couching their cases in terms of them being members of a particular social group that is being targeted. And it's, frankly, a messy legal analysis. It's not a simple thing, even for lawyers, to try to describe the motivations of the person that is harming these individuals.
So here's an example. Yes.
Okay, sorry.
No, please. I want to listen to you. Go ahead.
Right. There is an example that I can give you. Someone comes and they say, I came to the United States because the gangs wanted me to sell drugs, and they were forcing me to sell drugs on their behalf. And that in and of itself sounds like, if you just take that one sentence, that sounds like recruitment by the gangs, which just to gain manpower for the gangs, cases have held that kind of recruitment is not enough. But if you delve further and you say, well, gosh, why did they pick you, Brian, instead of your neighbor or someone else? And you say, well, I'm a member of a proselytizing evangelical sect where I always go door to door and talk to people. So they felt like I would be a great person to sell drugs because no one would suspect me. Not only am I clean cut, but I always go to people's houses and talk to them. Well, all of a sudden now you've introduced another element. Maybe you're being selected by the gangs because of your religious beliefs. And so maybe there is a different nexus. And so my point is that you can't make a generalization about these cases. We really need to spend time delving into all of the circumstances and then look at the relevant case law to decide why that person is being targeted and if that qualifies to make them a refugee.
But that limitation in the law that you were just describing, where you have to be part of a social group that's identifiable, is frustrating. It's almost heartbreaking. If somebody is being targeted for forcible recruitment into a gang just because they're vulnerable, just because the gang thinks they can get them to do it and build up their numbers of members or whatever, not because they're a member of some proselytizing religious organization or something, then they're not protected. And that would, I think, involve so many of these kids, at least from reading the press reports. It's kind of heartbreaking that there would be no protection for kids in that situation.
Well, judges don't make the law. They enforce the law that's on the books. So that is an issue that you need to raise with Congress. And that is partly why your compassionate impulse is certainly something that is very much shared by the majority of judges across the country. But we have to apply the law as it currently exists. Now, there may be some other remedies under the law which these children can qualify for. And it's the job of the immigration judge to make sure that we find out everything that we need to. Some people who have been victims of human traffickers, smugglers, may qualify for protection if they help cooperate with the government to try to prosecute those smugglers. People who have been victims of crimes in the United States can sometimes get status in that way. Children who have been abused or neglected or abandoned by one or both of their parents can qualify for status. Children who are joining other family members whose family members may have some status may be allowed to stay. So that's why it's not a cut and dry, easy to generalize kind of situation. It's really much more nuanced and complicated.
My guest on WNYC is the president of the National Association of Immigration Judges, Dana Lee Marks. She sits in an immigration court in San Francisco. And listeners, it's a rare opportunity to ask a question of an immigration judge and the president of the association of them, to boot, about how it really works in these deportation hearings for Central American minors here alone. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And I just should say, as we open the phones, that this segment is not for your political opinions. We take those a lot on this topic, and we will continue to. But for now, what do you want to learn about how this works from the president of the National Association of Immigration Judges? Even if you're a lawyer, you can ask the judge a question. 212-433-WNYC. Yvonne in Park Slope, you're on the air. Hello, Yvonne.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a little confused about how the gangs are seen, because given the description she gave of what's allowed as a qualification to for sanctuary here, it seems the gangs are an organization not controlled by the government. If they're out of control and the government cannot control them, doesn't that alone, by her description, make the these refugees qualified?
Judge?
Well, you can't make that generalization until you see the evidence that's presented in each individual case. And these kids are coming from various different countries. We have to look at the situation on the ground in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in Honduras, and in Mexico, and make the determination based on the evidence that's presented in the individual case. Because that is such a high standard and so difficult, that's why the National Association of Immigration Judges is in favor of programs which help kids connect with lawyers, be it legal orientation programs or know your rights programs or volunteer organizations, because a lot of people don't realize that because deportation is a civil proceeding, people are not guaranteed an appointed counsel through that proceeding.
Yvonne, thank you for your call. I'm told that New York has a good program relative to most places of the kind you were just describing. But talk more about what kind of due process these children are entitled to. They're not guaranteed, you just said, representation by an attorney. What are they guaranteed?
They are guaranteed a fair and impartial hearing, the right to present evidence, the right to have an attorney represent them if they so choose, the right to hear and contest any evidence that's presented against them. So they have many of the traditional due process rights. And as I said before, we can't just base our decisions on general information that we think we know is out there about a particular country. The judges are confined to the evidence presented in the case before them, in that record, and a juvenile has the opportunity to present evidence to try to persuade us, to present experts on country conditions. But all of those tasks are admittedly extremely difficult for someone who is unrepresented.
Let me just be clear, because I think I heard two different things. They are guaranteed a lawyer if they request one, or they aren't?
They are not guaranteed an appointed attorney that's paid for by the government, but they are guaranteed the right to have an attorney present if they can arrange for one. In other words, I can't say, oh, I don't need this attorney. I know what's going on in these countries.
And in New York City, there's been a big effort to get lawyers for these courts. The city council has provided $500,000 for that program. I think that's unique in the United States.
That's correct. It's very unique, but those lawyers are going to people who are detained rather than people, as are many of these juveniles, who are out either on a bond or on their own recognizance. So it's a fabulous first step that the association – we're very proud of you, New Yorkers. We think it's an excellent first step, and in fact, some of the preliminary data shows that it's in fact cost efficient to provide the lawyers, because the government is saving money on detention costs and the time it takes these cases to work through the system when people are unrepresented. So we're very excited about the preliminary results from that program,
Michelle,
and hope it will spread.
Michelle in Edison, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Brian. This is Michelle, first-time caller. Hey, I'm just wondering how much time it takes to do a case. I read somewhere that they were trying to force the judges to take about 35 children a day. I'm wondering if that the judges can really delve into these cases the way that they need to with that large amount of workload behind them.
There are two kinds of cases, two kinds of settings on the court docket, and the first is like an arraignment calendar. And when you hear that there's 35 cases a day being scheduled, that's like an arraignment calendar where we simply try to triage the case and find out what needs to be done before it's ready for an individual merits hearing. Believe me, the individual merits hearing where we consider whether these children have a viable claim to asylum or are entitled to any other form of relief usually takes several hours and lasts a lot longer.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And you sent us some stats from your organization from the immigration courts in New York and New Jersey. And the average number of days that cases are pending on the New York docket, 604. So that's getting close to 2 years. And in New Jersey, the average is one day shorter. So one of the go ahead.
Those statistics come from Syracuse University, the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse.
So you could look at that politically from either side. Advocates for the detainees, if they're being locked up for that amount of time, say, that's not fair. And then more from the conservative side, that this process allows people to stay in the country too long while their cases are being heard and they can disappear. Is either a legitimate, criticism in that it reflects reality?
Well, the cases of detainees are prioritized and do not take nearly that long. This is the average number combining everyone, both detained and non-detained. But the first priority in our system is to try to get detained cases moved through the system much more quickly. What's ironic is there are people that say, oh, delay benefits these people who are here illegally anyway. And in actuality, there are many people who do qualify for a benefit who are on the court's calendars. And so ironically, the strong and meritorious cases are the ones that suffer by the long delays in waiting for a hearing date, because they may lose touch with witnesses they need. They may need a qualifying relative to meet a statutory requirement, and that relative can become sick or die. Sometimes that qualifying relative needs to be a minor, and just by the passage of time, that minor becomes an adult. And on the opposite side, people who have weaker cases, which are going to ultimately be denied, those are the ones that benefit. So it is problematic that by moving cases forward, the cases of these recently arrived juveniles forward, that cases that have been on the court's calendars for longer periods of time will suffer. And there are many people, including the association, who are critical of that as not being the best solution to this problem, because cases of juveniles need more time, usually, to be prepared. It's our job to make sure that someone who appears before the court understands both their rights and their responsibilities, and to try to work with a child to make sure they fully understand that we have some trust and rapport so that they're willing to tell some of these difficult and traumatic stories to a complete stranger. Sometimes those stories, if they involve sexual assault, are very shameful for these kids, and they, kids often feel they've brought something upon themselves and feel guilty. So to work through all of those psychological aspects, it takes more time for judges, and we have to go more slowly in the cases of juveniles, particularly if they don't have an attorney to represent them.
Judge Denalee Marks, our guest on WNYC, president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. And Gil in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Gil.
Hi, thank you. I was just wondering how many judges, or if there are judges, how many immigration judges are elected or appointed, or I don't really know what the percentage are, or if any are elected. I was just wondering about that mix, and also if you're in your experience or your awareness of the mix of immigration judges across the country, how many would be affiliated with either party or be sympathetic to this issue in terms of adjudication on the positive side for the minors? And also, does it really make any difference where a minor finds himself or herself in the country, given that, you know, given this whole mix.
If they're if they're in immigration court in Texas compared to New York City,
yeah,
for example.
Texas, New York, or
yeah,
where
the different politics in the areas. Well, to his first question, are you immigration judges presidentially appointed and confirmed by the Senate?
No, we are executive branch employees. It's something that's an arcane piece of information about the immigration courts. So we are appointed by the Attorney General in a non-political manner, and our ranks do reflect a diversity of people who've come from the private practice of immigration law, as well as people who have been government prosecutors in the immigration enforcement system. So there's a mix, and then there's also a mix of people with other backgrounds, other judicial backgrounds, like military judges or state court judges. So politics are not considered. It is not supposed to be a factor in terms of hiring immigration judges. So we are career civil servants.
May I ask which attorney general appointed you a judge?
Yes, I'm actually a Reagan appointee, but I am one of the first people who came from a private practice background. And in fact, personally, I was successful in arguing a United States Supreme Court case that was in favor of refugees, making a more generous standard for asylum cases. So that goes to show that it's not a political process. As to where, or I'm one example of showing that it is not, where matters, where your case is heard matters, not so much for who your judge is, but as to whether you're going to have access to pro bono counsel. If you are in a small rural area, you are probably going to have a lot more difficult time finding experienced immigration attorneys that you can hire either for money or certainly who are able to volunteer their services. So I would say, and there have been studies done, that there is a big disparity in terms of success or failure on someone's application for asylum based on whether or not they are represented by attorneys, for all the reasons we've talked about earlier, about how complicated it is to get the evidence which is needed. So the biggest bonus for someone is if they are living in an area where the lawyers have rallied together to help provide volunteer services.
And I want to play a soundbite of Vice President Biden from just yesterday. Since you brought that up, here is Joe Biden on exactly that point.
We need lawyers. We need trained lawyers to determine whether or not these kids meet the criteria for refugee status and or whether or not they are in such jeopardy if they don't gain at least continued safety and security that they're going to be sent to something that will be their physical demise.
Vice President Biden yesterday. So, Judge, who provides those lawyers? Is it something that Congress could provide by approving funding, or is it just left to a kind of locality-by-locality basis, like you were comparing New York to some other places?
It's both. Congress could allocate funding, and as part of the Know Your Rights presentations and the legal orientation programs, we can get a lot more advice out there to people and help direct them to coordinate other volunteer efforts. The president announced 100 AmeriCorps volunteers would be devoted towards that purpose. But yes, Congress is the one that ultimately would have to allocate monies and allow the Department of Justice to provide funding to assist nonprofit groups to provide lawyers at no expense to the individuals that they're representing.
Felice in Pleasantville, you're on WNYC. Hello, Felice.
Hi. I just wanted to ask you, the rights that you enumerated of the children sound very impressive, but unless that they have lawyers appointed to advise them of that right, how old do you think a child actually has to be to effectively exercise any of these rights unless they are advised of what they are and how to do that?
It's an interesting question. The judges are responsible for assuring that someone before them does not have their rights encroached upon, whether the individual is aware of those rights or not. The law provides that a child who is under 14 can't make an admission that we would use to prove that they are not a U.S. citizen. So you can get in kind of a stalemate situation if you have a 5 or 6 year old child who has no responsible adult with him or her and no lawyer appointing them, then it would be up to the immigration authorities to try to track down who is this child and prove that this person was not born in the United States. So there are some practical problems. In terms of an individual child's capacity, it really varies based on what kind of trauma they have experienced. And, you know, we have adults who come in suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder based on what has happened. And so certainly children, because of their vulnerabilities, are often less able to articulate and tell stories in a chronologically accurate way. And so there's all kinds of difficulties that occur, and that's why the judges need to really spend a lot of time on each case to make sure that the individual, the child's rights are protected.
We're just about out of time, but I'm curious, based on your experience, what percentage of these estimated 58,000 unaccompanied minors, if they all were to come through immigration courts in the next little bit of time, what percentage do you think, under the criteria of the law that you laid out, the judges have to adhere to, what percentage would be sent back?
Sorry, Brian. I have no idea. It's very difficult to generalize, and we judges don't think of things in that way. We look at each case that's before us with a clean slate and an open mind and decide them case by case.
My guest has been the president of the National Association of Immigration Judges, Dana Lee Marks. Thank you so much. This has been so informative. Good luck in your courtroom.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up. What does it take for a product to be certifiably made in Brooklyn? There is a new Brooklyn-made label being unveiled by the Brooklyn Chamber of Commerce. We'll talk to the president of the Brooklyn Chamber of Commerce next. Stay with us.